I know that you can hear the Mother Earth call. I know that you can hear the Mother Earth call. Devastated soul through the door and down the hall. But on the way, you stumble, fall, and crawl.
Hey, this is Mateo. What's up, everybody? How you doing? Mateo from Lost Souls Radio. And also, as you know, I have a brother, Yao. But guess what? He's not here today. He's taking care of something. But we're going to keep moving on because it's important for us to continue in sharing our stories throughout the diaspora of Turtle Island of our community. So with that said, usually we do our check-in. And just a quick update with Lost Souls Radio. We're coming back up to the last two quarters of the year, the Gregorian calendar. We do have some guests that you're going to really enjoy. One we've had in the past, and we have a new guest joining us today. And I'm going to share who that is just in a bit. But today, ladies and gents and everyone else who clicks on that play button, today we're going to be talking about a brother named Roberto Sintley Rodriguez, who many of you have heard that he recently became an ancestor. Roberto, who was a PhD of mass communication through University of Wisconsin-Madison. And that's just something that in the academic world, but as you know, that he has contributed so much to the multiple generations that live within our communities. And the guest who we have today, who are going to be sharing about the brother. We have the brother, Luis Rodriguez. As you know, he's a poet. He's also known for the book of Always Running. In addition to, we have our sister, Raquel Salinas. And if you haven't seen her work, you got to see her work. She is one of the main contributors of Chicanas, Cholas, and Chisme. So let's take a moment and let's welcome in these two relatives right here joining us on Lost Souls Radio. And usually when the caracoles are playing, as y'all know, y'all and I are like poking each other, making sure we're all sitting upright and stuff because we still got some trauma from our private school days. Alright, well, welcome, Luis and Raquel. Thank you for joining us on Lost Souls Radio. It's always an honor to be speaking with you, and it's just a beautiful thing to have you share some the existence and the legacy of Roberto. But how are you both doing?
I'm doing great. I mean, you know, with the hurricane going on and earthquakes, we're hanging in there really good.
Right. How are you doing, Raquel?
I'm doing well, thank you. Yeah, right. I'm doing well also, you know, just staying indoors and decluttering and finding things I haven't seen for a long time. And because you asked me to be here and speak about my brother, Roberto, I found a magazine that I'll talk a little bit about later.
Yeah, treasure. Yeah. What would you mind? I mean, you know, share a little bit about him, Raquel. How Roberto, came into your path.
Well, I met him. It might have been maybe 1980, 81. I had known that he was working for Lowriders magazine as a reporter, and I actually was got my picture taken in the Boulevard Nights magazine, not as one of those supermodels, but I was at Boulevard Nights opening when the theater was right there on Whittier Boulevard, and I was with the welterweight champion. I think his last name was Palomino, but I don't remember his first name. It's been
Carlos.
So long ago. Carlos Palomino. Carlos. Yeah. So I was on his arm, and I didn't even know who he was. And everybody, it was like, you know who you're holding out to? That's a welterweight champion of the world. It was like, I was so young, you know. And anyway, I met him through Barbara Carrasco. They were dating at that time. They had graduated from UCLA, and Barbara was doing her mural, working on a mural called Ali's History, A Mexican Perspective. So I started working on fundraisers with her. And then I met him. And soon after, that's when everything happened with him being beat up by the cops and him fighting that case against the LA sheriffs. And we started doing fundraisers at Rudy's Pasta House, both for Barbara's mural at one time and then other times for to raise monies for Roberto's attorney to fight that case.
What
so that's just the beginning of our long life relationship.
What happened? Can you share real quick what happened,
honestly, as a teenager, I used to cruise Whittier Boulevard, you know, and the lowriders, even though I didn't have a lowrider, but I, you know, that's what we used to do to meet guys and, you know, see all the cute guys and that kind of stuff. So I remember seeing the cops pull people over and drag guys or girls by their hair and sit them on the curb. And it was happening quite frequently, you know. And so Roberto went down there to cover that story. And as he was photographing them doing that, they assaulted him. Even though they said he assaulted them with the camera, they assaulted him and beat him up. That's what happened there. I wasn't there. I didn't see it. I just know that is what happened. And so, therefore, he did that lawsuit against the LA sheriffs, and he won. And with that money, he started a magazine. Anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And he did a lot of writing about that, and it really affected him, you know, traumatically. Throughout his whole life, I believe, you know, so he always struggled with that, the PTSD, and I did too with my own story, what happened to me, but that we had that connection with each other and that trust, trusting relationship, and the kind of work that we did, and the involvement we had with the Chicano Latino community at that time.
And Luis, how did you cross paths or in regards to Roberto Sintley?
Well, I have to say it was around the same time. And I don't remember if we knew each other, Raquel. We probably bumped into each other. I showed up to all the fundraisers. I knew Barbara very well. I met Roberto Coma in 1978. And what we were doing is there was a Latino Writers Association. And I joined it. I didn't start it. I just joined it. It was already there. Roberto was one of the people that would eventually be part of it. He used to be the editor of La Gente in UCLA, and I think he was working for a lowrider too. And I think what connected me and him was the lowriding scene. I had three lowriders in my life. I also, like Raquel, I cruised the boulevard. I used to, my first wife lived there in East LA. She lived on Ferris, City Terrace, and then she moved to Ferris. When I married her at the Guadalupe Church on Hazard, our reception was there on Ferris. So Whittier Boulevard was right there. Whittier and the cruising was going on. And I think it was two things that united me and Roberto. One is the lowriding scene. Because not every Chicano that was there was into lowriding. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was Chicano, the word. For some reason, it had stopped being used. And we were part of this thing called the Los Angeles Latino Writers Association. But I had never heard Latino being used for Mexicans. I just never. We always used Chicanos or Mexicans. We never used Latino. That was Hispanics probably, but not Latino. And I always thought it was an East Coast thing. But it didn't matter. We joined that group. We were the Bodies Writers Workshop. We loved the work we were doing. I was a writer. He was a writer. I was a journalist. He was a journalist. And I wasn't there either when he got beaten by the sheriffs. But I was part of his, I guess, campaign. I'm sure, Raquel, we bumped into each other.
Yes.
We didn't look the same. I'm sure we looked all young and beautiful.
Yes.
now we're just old and beautiful. But everybody was so young and so good looking in those days. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just remember everybody. All my good friends, Barbara, even Harry, her husband, we were all so young and full of life and energy. It was a really good time to be in East LA, I thought.
Yes.
And it was full of life. There was poetry. There was music. There was the art. There was the mural. There was Osco. I became associate editor, and then I edited one of the Chismarte magazines. Mm-hmm. They gave me an office right off Old Brooklyn Avenue Self-Help Graphics. Sister Karen gave me that office, and I was doing the work out of there. So that's how I knew Roberto. And just to know, just to let you know, we were friends for 45 years. Even when I moved to Chicago in 85, I ended up in Chicago. He would come to Chicago, and we hooked up, and we talked, and we and I knew Patricia Gonzalez, his wife, before he knew her. She had wanted some help because I came out of the summer program for minority journalists, and she had wanted some help. I didn't know her from Adam, but she contacted me and wanted some help trying to get in that program, and I helped her out. I didn't know her either, but we became friends. And then later on, Roberto and her became, you know, partners. I thought it was a great, thing because they were both my friends. And I also was there when he came up with his book, when they had the column. That they had a, they had his national column. He was also, when he was in Wisconsin, I think he was getting a degree. And I lived in Chicago, so it was easy to contact with him. We stayed in touch. And even when I came back to L.A., he came out with a number of books that I think are seminal, important books. The one of the, besides the first one, The Assault with Deadly Weapon, which talks about his case, the one big contribution he made, I thought, in his books, there's so many, but one of them was the importance of corn as the unifying thread throughout the Americas for all indigenous people. Because corn started around, you know, Mesoamerica, they call it Mesoamerica, you know, the Mexico and then Central America, but it spread all over the Americas. Corn is up in Canada. It might even be further than that. It's all down South America. Corn really united the ancestral peoples of this land. And he brought that out to say how we were one people based on corn. You know what I'm saying? It's such an important thing to put forward. And so we were friends because he was putting forward this really important aspect of our culture that many times a lot of people forgot, that we were indigenous, that we had roots that were as deep as anybody. And he studied and researched a lot of things that helped the development of the Chicanx conscience. You know what I'm saying? When he was in Arizona, he took on the battle against the destruction of racial studies that the racists were doing in Arizona. And he was a leader in that battle. I know because I got word from him about my book being banned in Arizona. I went down there to Phoenix and I think later Tucson, help him out as well. So we've been close friends, and I will have to say the last time I saw him, it was in Mexico City last November. I was doing a number of readings for the Chicano Sin Frontera group there. And we were at UNAM, and we were doing the venues in Mexico City and other places. And we were in the Colonia Roma, which is a very hip, you know, high-class community. And there was a reading there with all these Mexican and Chicano poets. And I was there, and Roberto shows up. I go, Roberto, my brother, I was so glad to see him. I knew he was in Mexico City. I didn't really know how to reach him, but he shows up. And he's always been that way. He's always been somebody that goes out of his way, reaches out to you. He was in touch with everybody. We were talking about doing something at Tia Chucha's, which we actually talked just before I heard that he passed, that he contacted me about trying to do something at Tia Chucha's for a new book he was working on, or he finished, I'm not sure. Anyway, it was really extremely sad when I got word that he had passed, that the way he had passed from heart issues in Mexico City. He lived around Teotihuacan. And it was just heartbreaking because he contributed so much, gave so much awareness and knowledge to our community and took it all over. I have to say he's one of a kind. He's the one that talked the talk and walked the walk. That was Roberto.
Well, thank you for sharing that, Luis. Raquel, you want to add on to or share something that you have?
Well, I think Roberto and mine's relationship, I felt like it was like a really close relationship because of our politics. You know, he would make fun of me. He would call me Dialakos because every U.S. out of Central America, ay voy. No on 187, ay voy las marchas. You know, the UFW movement and, you know, the people in Guatemala. He really got close with this organization that was working for Guatemalan rights. And he started connecting with them because of the PTSD that they identified with. You know, he said, you know, I think I'm identifying with them with the PTSD. You know, I think that's what I have. Yeah, that's when he first started exploring that that's what he had. You know, it was a new term that these psychologists or psychiatrists were identifying with the Guatemalan community that were tortured and how, you know. And so for him, he had that connection with them and had a relationship with them. And then I started getting involved. Well, I was a student at Northridge, and I was getting involved more and more in the Central American, you know, movement that right here downtown LA, 7th and Alvarado, MASPS and CISPES and all these different organizations. And I would say, oye, ¿por qué no se pueden unir ustedes como salvadoreños? And then I'm like, who are we to talk? Chicanos can't get together either, you know? So who am I to ask that, you know? I just didn't get it, but there were different factions. But I got along with all of them because that's just the kind of person I was, you know? And it's just like, I just wanted it to stop U.S. out of Central America, you know, to get those, you know, the whole Reaganomics, todo eso, you know, we lived through all of that, you know, and always having a voice, always saying something, always standing up. Like, I remember, you know, I grew up going to this church in by Olvera Street. And I quit going when I was like 15 years old, but my father would go down there on the weekends and help clean the church. And one day I'm in an immigration march, you know, I'm marching down and there's my dad on the bridge and he goes, hola, mija, ¿dónde vas? And I go, soy marchando, papá, véngase. No, tú ve. Like he already knew. They had just accepted that it was going to be, like my mom, I would go home and she'd say, okay, ¿qué estamos boicoteando? Ponlo aquí en la lista, en el bulletin board. Like she already knew, like instead of fighting with me about not going or don't go, because I went to the Chicano moratorium as a teenager, you know, to protest the war against Vietnam because my brother was given the ultimatum to go or be deported. And so I went to march. My mom didn't want me to go. She worked on Whittier Boulevard at Melody Shop. She says, no vas. And I go, pero mi prima Olga y Julia y Estela, todas van a ir. Pero tú no. And I went anyway. You know, it's like my brother, you know, I'm blessed that he came back. But I think that was a pivotal moment in my life at the moratorium. When I saw the cops coming from the back of the park, busting heads, that's when I didn't like police officers very much after that, you know, with the whole, you know, matando Ruben Salazar, you know, you know, Roberto used to collect his articles, Ruben Salazar's articles. It was very important to him. And I don't know what he ever did with them, but he had copies of them. He probably has them in his boxes of collection, you know, so after the whole, after Barbara Carrasco and all that, and they were very good friends, him, Barbara Francis and Roberto, Francis Carrasco was Barbara's sister, and they started a magazine called Corazón de Aztlán. And there's an article by Bert Corona on stopping the deportations and Carlos Jimenez, a crisis in the Chicano schools. And then who declared war on the word Chicano? Roberto wrote that one. And the ins and outs, you know, about being harassed by the INS. Harry Gamboa wrote an article. And, you know, Frank Cifuentes and all these different people that, you know, Mary Helen Ponce wrote on women and cancer. Vatos in the Pentagon. Like, and lowriders, Do It Low and Slow, artwork by Felipe Mendoza, like all these artists coming together. It was about arte, cultura, poesía, you know, like the whole Chicano movimiento was strong and alive. I know, like what Luis was talking about, like, why did we stop using the word Chicano? And all of a sudden, I think because when the Central Americans started coming in and then, you know, Puerto Ricans, like different people from, you know, Guatemalans, I think then we started becoming more either Hispanic, and then we fought against that word, and then we became Latino, and now we're Latinx. What's next? I don't know, you know, but se burlaba de mí, Roberto, you know, but then at the same time, we both started going through our spiritual path, you know, me following the Red Road, Native American ceremony, and then he started doing runs, like running for the indigenous people, and that was his way of prayer, you know, by running. And anyway, those are the connections we had. Then when one day he called me, I think when he was at the University of Wisconsin, I don't know if he was working on some kind of degree, master's degree, no sé. But he met Patricia and he called me because we were friends, you know. He would be like, guess what? I think I met my future wife. Really, Roberto, really? He goes, yeah, I'm going to take her mariachi. I was like, wow, man, this is serious. You know, so they ended up getting married and both teaching at the same university. And they moved and taught a lot of young people. And that's what I love. Like when I started seeing all the comments after he passed, you know, and how many people he mentored, both him and Patricia Gonzalez, I was like, wow, you know, it just, I couldn't look at it anymore. I was just like crying. And like, it was very shocking to me as I was at work. And then I got a text from my friend Nancy, and she, you know, she said, call me right away. And then she told me and gave me Patricia's number. Like, it's funny because when they split up, she says, you know, why are you staying friends with that guy? Because he's my friend. You're her friend. He's my friend. I love them both, but he's my friend, you know? And, you know, we were just there for each other. Today, I was watching a video of one of my old work solo performances called Mami, Mami, Quien Soy, You Know Who You Are. It was about my mom having dementia. And while I was living it, in 2009, on my opening day, on May 11th, 2009, she dies. Mm-hmm. And the show must go on. And who was there? Roberto Rodriguez and Cuicui Rangel. Those are my friends from way back. Cuicui Rangel was playing with Califas, and she'd play at all our fundraisers at Rudy's Pasta House with the band Califas. And we still stay friends and we stay connected. And he would come to LA and invite us both to dinner with his family. We knew his family. And I also did this modeling to get rid of the shame behind being a rape survivor and having my mom tell me que Dios me castigó por andar en la calle. You know, no one knew why I modeled for that, but it was to get rid of the shame, you know, behind like always like wanting to hide my body. But I told Roberto, you know, Alma López is getting all this notoriety. And I don't really, it's not a big deal, but no one's hearing my voice. Everybody's attacking her, but no one knows my story. And he goes, would you give us permission to write a story? So him and Patricia in their column of the Americas, him and Patricia co-wrote my story about what happened. And it touched a lot of women who said that it helped them give voice to what happened to them. I started getting all kinds of emails after that. It was like my email was inundated with emails from people from all over because of that one article. So I have a lot of respect in all his writing and the power of the word, like what Luis does, you know, all the youth that he touches with his writing. Like you, we've even done plays on Luis's book, you know, at Casa 0101. And it's like, it's just important to keep giving voice to voices seldom heard. It's important to share our stories. It's important to keep teaching our youth that they have a voice, you know, and that we continue, you know, the legacy of Roberto, you know, to educate ourselves and educate others through our work, through our art, through cultura.
I was going to ask you both. I know you mentioned about the situation with the sheriffs. Did that experience influence Roberto to go towards Wisconsin, or did that push him that way versus like staying here with the Islos?
I don't think he ever felt safe in LA, but I don't know. Yeah. I don't know that trajectory.
But the only thing, I'm not sure that was directly, but I do know that what he did create as part of his struggle about the police was the Raza Killings database.
That's right.
Which is very important because he was now documenting, this is for California State University, I think it was LA, all the murders of Chicanos and other you know, Central Americans, Puerto Ricans, other people that were being killed by the police, because what was happening is blacks were disproportionately being killed, but it was all becoming like a black and white thing when Chicanos and others had been being killed for a long time. Mm-hmm. And he was wanting to document that. Mm-hmm. So I think that pushed him in that direction. One thing I would have to add, this is very rich, Raquel. I really appreciate everything you're putting forward, because it's opening up to stuff I usually don't talk about, but I think it's important. I also been diagnosed with PTSD. I never talk about it, but it's all in my books, everything. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was very important for me is because I got beaten up with cops two times, and they killed four of my friends, the sheriff's deputies. They killed three of my friends. San Gabriel Police Department killed one of them. Two of them were my best friends. The sheriff killed my best friend, Miguel Robles, and my other best friend, Ruben Martinez. And they were teenagers, 17, 18 years old when they died. I was around the same age. Now, one thing that people don't know is there really wasn't that much shootings or drive-bys between Chicanos in the 60s. People say it started in the 60s. It didn't really. Maybe late 60s in some barrios, but it was mostly in the early 70s. What happened in my neighborhood is that we weren't killing each other with guns. We were fighting. There was a lot of weapons, and there was knives and all kinds of things. What the sheriffs killed the first person in my neighborhood with a gun. And then soon after is when another body came and killed another homeboy. And then that escalated. And I also think that the cops made sure that everybody had guns, because guns were available. People had them, but man, they started coming in really having duty. And then the Vietnam War brought a lot of veteranos coming in out of the war, many of them mentally impacted, PTSD, yeah. And some of them ended up elevating the level of violence and the use of guns. Of course, heroin too. Heroin was always a problem in the body since after World War II, but it got big again during the Vietnam War. I was living through that time, so I know exactly what Raquel's talking about. Mm-hmm. The other time I got beaten up was I actually wasn't as Raquel was. I was in the Chicano moratorium, but I actually was one of the guys that got beaten. I'm one of the first guys they beat up, because I was in the liquor store that had been robbing the beer that started everything. And I have to say, there was my homeboys, probably some other homies, but my homeboys in particular, that started it. They could have, the sheriffs and the other officers could have isolated us, could have arrested us, could have isolated it. But they were looking for any excuse to attack the mostly peaceful group. We were their excuse. I hate to say that, but that's kind of our fault. And I write this in Always Winning. We were the ones that started the stealing. And then they'd use that as an excuse to attack everybody. And so what happened is they started attacking everybody. They told me with a shotgun to my head to get the hell out. But when I saw what was going on, I witnessed them beating up all these innocent people. People were peaceful.
Yes, they were.
I raged, and I went back towards the cops. That's just me. I went back towards the cops, and sure enough, they jumped on me, beat the heck out of me. I was bleeding as they put me into the car, the patrol car. And then they took me through various jails and juvenile hall. The one thing you should know is several hundred people were arrested, but they were all let go for the most part in 2 or 3 hours. They kept five of us, cholos, original guys that had stolen, and put us in murderer's row. And the reason why they were going to charge us for the murders of the people that were being killed in the so-called East LA riot, which it turned out we weren't killing nobody. The police were killing them, including Ruben Salazar. So, but I was there in murderer's row next to Charles Manson, because he was going to trial at the time. The first night I was there, these two big black guys tried to kill me, but I stood up to them because I'd already been in the street. I've been in the street since I was 11, 12 years old. I was already homeless by the time the moratorium happened. I was homeless for 3 years, and so I wasn't scared of anybody, and they were surprised. These are big guys. They were surprised that I wasn't scared. They had a razor blade to my neck. I stood up to them, and then they said, okay, fine. We played cards all night long. But one thing that came out of that experience, I was there for several days and nights, and I started to write my first poems. I didn't know they were poems. I was just starting to write my thoughts. People were playing cards. They were drawing. They were whatever. Somebody had a pen and pencil for some reason, and I started writing a pencil. And I don't know how they got it, but they got it. And I started writing some stuff. After several days and nights, I was there when Ruben Salazar was killed because we had did a little riot. And people don't know this part. We were all the Chicano. The murderer's role had nothing but blacks and Chicanos except for the one white guy, Charles Manson. And they had him in a special cell so nobody could kill him. Everybody wanted to kill him. We couldn't get to him. But what happened is when we heard, when the radio was on, and we heard that Ruben Salazar was killed, people started rattling and getting pissed. All the Chicanos in the tank started rattling, screaming, and yelling. And one guy started burning a mattress. And we were going to go full out riot. But what happened is the sheriff's deputies closed off everything. And we got smoked out. You know, the red mattress was actually hurting us, and we had to get water and put it in our faces. Actually, it was not a good, it wasn't very smart. It wasn't a good move. But the sheriff didn't care. They came in later and broke one guy's arm, beat the rest of us in the tank. Yeah, these are things that made me a revolutionary, I have to say.
Yes.
Because after that, I stopped being, I didn't want to, it took me maybe 2 or 3 more years. I was on heroin, I was homeless. I was in a gang. But after that, I started to think about the Chicano movement. I started thinking about, man, I'm going to go to this movement. I'm going to go through this pain. I'm going to do it for something. And it was the beginning. They kind of made a revolutionary out of me that during those days. And I have to mention that because, again, that's Roberto's legacy. Roberto was one of those guys that spoke out about it. I later got beat up again when I was 18. And I was... you know, after I was club in Montebello, and I was walking out, and I was still on drugs and drinking and everything, and the cops were beating up this young Chicana, and she was handcuffed on the ground, and she was already on the ground. They were kicking her and beating her up. 8 cops, and everybody was walking away. All the homies and everybody, all the hardcore guys, they were walking away because, you know, when you're a gangster, that's none of your business.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And I knew that I was no longer gangster thinking because I didn't walk away. I stepped up to the cops, yelled at them, stop beating her, which was the reason why they jumped on me. I didn't even get a lick in, man. I should have got at least one lick in. They got me so fast, and they beat the hell out of me again. And this time, they took me to the Norwalk Sheriff Station. And before they took me in, they drove around several blocks. 2 cops on one side, me handcuffed in the middle, and beat me up before I got to the sheriff's substation. So I kind of related to everything Roberto was doing. And when he got beat up, I understood. We talked about this. The fact, though, that he actually won, he got $205,000. Took him several years, I think in 86. But that he took him on and won. Because, you know, when they killed my friends, their families actually put lawsuits, but they didn't win.
No.
The cops never got dismissed. This was a case in which Roberto stood for all of us. His winning was our winning. You know what I'm saying? It's like he took him on. He didn't let it go. And he got that money. And he used that money to continue the movement, continue putting publications out. I actually was in Corazón de Aslan. There should be an article there that I wrote or something or an interview. I forget how it was. But that was his legacy. And he took that struggle, like I said, all the way to the present where he started the Raza Killings database. In other words, he wasn't forgetting. And as we know, cops have continued to kill people. And George Floyd just opened up the whole wound for the whole world. But Chicanos have had a terrible legacy of cops attacking us from a long, long time, disproportionately to anybody other than blacks, but right not too far from black people. I myself went through that. Again, I've been diagnosed PTSD. I don't tell anybody. I just write about my stuff. I don't say it. But I knew exactly what Roberto was going through. And that's why I think we were very close. It's probably the reason why Raquel and him were close. Anybody that goes through this kind of traumas, and then we became revolutionary activists, all of us, Raquel as well. I mean, we all took on the system. We marched. And I went to Central America. I did a lot of work there. I went to as a freelancer, covered stories of uprisings in Uchitán, Oaxaca, and Campesinos, the Zapotecos, when they were uprising. I covered those stories because I wanted to be that kind of journalist that in many ways, Roberto was the example. Mm-hmm. See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. He was leading the way, and I ended up taking up the same example. I became a journalist in 1980. He was already doing the work that I wanted to do. And just so you know, like him, I was very much taken by Ruben Salazar's work. He became a model for me. And I even named one of my sons after Ruben Salazar, my son Ruben. In other words, I think what Raquel is pointing out, and what we're all, I'm glad we're having this discussion, where we're older now. I'm 69 this year. Roberto was 69, the same age. We're carrying through a lot of trauma and pain, but I think, like I saw Raquel do, and I saw him do, we turned it to art, we turned it to writing, we turned it to theater, as Raquel does all the work that she does. I did it to poetry and all the work that I did working with gang kids, you know, and even going to Central America, working in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, and of course all over Mexico. In other words, we took it back to our community. It wasn't like we got PTSD and then we got stuck in it, even though it is hard, and we do get stuck. I've been stuck. Besides 8 years, 7 years of heroin, I was 20 years of drinking. I think it was related to all that stuff. But since I got sober, and just like Roberto and Raquel, it was my indigenous, the Red Road, as Raquel talks about, that helped me 30 years ago. And then me and Trini embarked together. And Trini, of course, is very strong in that area. We did it together. She did it. She saw me finding my sobriety through that road. And she got into it herself because she's got her issues. She's got her traumas and pain. So I think this is very important, Raquel and Mateo, that we talk about this, because I think Roberto represented the PTSD, the trauma, the pain, but he represented, turned it into something powerful, turned it into something valuable, turned it into something that will teach, that will expand our communities, that would elevate us as people. That's what Roberto represented.
Yes.
No, that's...
And I remember, like, right after he won that, the case that he started America's 2001 magazine, that's probably where you were in, remember?
Yeah.
And we
we
had a fundraiser downtown LA, and Ruben Blades came and he played at our fundraiser, and I got to meet him for the first time. And I understand he was here this past week, and then I wasn't here because after Roberto passed, we did a private ceremony for him in Whittier, and I took off. I'm a runner. Talk about always running. I run from the pain. I went and helped a friend up north and did like some helping in the garden and some manual labor to get it out of me. I went hiking. I was with nature. And I didn't want to go to those big community gatherings for him. No disrespect, but it just was so painful because we lost a soldado, you know. His voice lives on through his writings, you know. I'm grateful that I didn't listen to my mother and I went to the Chicano moratorium. I never knew that side of your story, Luis, but like I thought they made it up that there was people stealing beer at the moratorium. That's true. Where it all started. But they blamed you guys. And I know I marched peacefully and it was a peaceful, you know, I wrote a piece about it. It's called, you know, red, white, and blue, red, white, and green. About my experience in marching, because of that, I became conscientizada after that. My cousin started teaching me about the Black Panthers and what they were doing in their community and the breakfast program. And I was selling buttons, free Bobby Seale and all this stuff, you know, and all that came from that anger that I had against the cops for what they did to our gente. You know, my brother being in Vietnam, seeing my mother cry at night for him, you know, I think, like, you know, I went to Nicaragua to, you know, with a Chicano delegation to Nicaragua and Barbara Carrasco and Irena Cervantes, all these artists, doing theater over there and stuff. And then I went in 96, I went with the Zapatistas to a conferencia over there in, you know, contra el neoliberalismo. I had to learn how to say that word before I went over there. But just as an artist, you know, to share with the women and interview the women in the kitchen and tell their stories. And that's what it's about. Like, one thing that I love about Mateo and the work that y'all and what they're doing is, like, Mateo and I have been friends from Cal State Northridge, and he's telling stories about men and their pain. You know, we don't hear those stories. So when he invited me, you know, to see them perform, I was like in awe of them. I'm like, yes, now I'm hearing the men's voices. Oh, they feel like we do, because you never hear the pain until somebody puts it in writing and tells the story through theater or whatever medium. And if any last words, I would just say, you know, let's keep his, Roberto, Dr. Singley Rodriguez, you know, keep his legacy alive by continuing to do our work through whatever art form or writing, whatever you do.
Yeah, I agree with that. Thank you. Raquel, this is so rich. I've known you for a long time and I didn't really know you. I think I learned more. I just have to add that I also ended up in Nicaragua. It was really interesting that we never really bumped into each other that I could tell, but I was there and I also ended up covering the Contra War. I fell right in the middle of a war. So I was in Nicaragua when the Sandinistas took me to southern Honduras, where I got shot at with 50 caliber bullets and got bombed twice by the Contras. Yeah, I know. And we survived it all. I didn't get hurt, but definitely the CIA confiscated all my cameras. They did it in my Glendale, Miami. Mm. Yeah, they got most of my film, but I still got some of it. I still got some things from there. I think our paths crossed because knowing Roberto, but knowing that Raquel, I'm just so rich in what you're talking about, what you've been through, and knowing that you've been part of the same things that I've been part of and the struggles, it just goes to show that the movimiento is powerful, it's real. Now, of course, me and Trini do a lot of healing work because we know that that's part of the revolutionary work. Healing is a revolutionary act, and we have to include it because there's been so much trauma, so much pain. As you know, my own son got into the prisons. He got beaten by the cops. He was facing 40 years to life. We dealt with that. And then, of course, I have other family members. I just lost a grandson to fentanyl last November. And then my granddaughter just got out of prison, his sister, for crystal meth. We're still addressing the issues that have hurt us for generations. And I feel that, Raquel, your words, I know I've seen you at Casa 0101. I've seen the powerful things you've done. I think we have to keep doing it, but also, as Roberto was doing, training young people, bringing these young people into the mold, into this fold. We got to continue the struggle, and that's what Roberto was about. If anything, I would just say that's his legacy. He was a strong soldier for our raza, for our gente, and we got to continue in that way and help engender new leaders, new poets, new theater people, new artists to come out and do that work.
Yes.
Yeah, no, definitely. Thank you.
Thank you, Mateo.
Thank you. Thank you both for sharing your experiences, highlighting Roberto's life. It's so important. And that's really what the intention about Lasso's Radio is, to highlight our community's voice throughout the diaspora of what we like to refer to as Turtle Island. I will say that the one time that I remember Roberto, how I kind of got introduced to him, him and Patricia wrote about some Chicano artists, and they included my friend Marisol Torres. And I remember, like, I think we were still, I was still in college with them. We were just so excited that, I mean, we were just young Chicano activists. And it was like, what? We're like, we're coming up. I was like, it was so beautiful. Because at the time for us, it was so in awe to see brown people in the academic world. And it was just like, it was like mind blowing that, at least for myself, that brown people have been doing this work before, you know, even take a Chicano or an Indigenous Studies class, which totally just blew my mind. And that was kind of like my experience with them. And then one other time with not only reading his books, but how he did some work and interviewed Tata Kwashle. And I remember he was at my children's school where they were doing a ceremony. And he was sitting there. Like, he just finished his book. And he was sitting there off to the side, and everybody's dancing, they're doing their thing. And as I walked away, you good? He's like, yeah, I'm just listening, enjoying being alive. And I was like, at that time, I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. But he was, now that I'm reflecting back, he was really in the moment of ceremony, appreciating all these babies doing danza that don't have some of the stuff mm-hmm. that us adults carry. Right. And that's what totally, you know, when people pass away, isn't it weird how automatically these experiences just come right back like it was a few seconds ago? But thank you both. Yeah. At this time, would you like to do any last honoring for Roberto, even if somebody else maybe that is needs a verbal prayer that's needs to be acknowledged? If you know someone, and this is the time where if you want to just honor that person, and then we'll close out in the best way that we can.
All right. Unfortunately, I have so many people that are sick right now. I don't want to necessarily mention them, but I pray for all of them. I send prayers for all the people. I've lost a lot of friends. I lost four of them in the last, the last 10 years to suicides. It's we're still carrying it. And this is why I love that Roberto represented what we're trying to represent, which is to keep la esperanza and that loving blossoming of our truths to keep going. And that's what I hope to bring out there. So I don't want to mention anyone in particular, but I do have a lot of people sending prayers to who are not doing too good right now, and in the hopes that they'll get well. But we're losing a lot of people now. So Raquel, you and me, Mateo, we got to stay strong and healthy.
Yeah.
We got a lot of work to do.
Thank you, Luis. Raquel, what about you?
I just want to say that, like Louis, you know, I have my recovery through the Red Road, and we have ceremony, and that's where I take my prayers. And I don't want to ask for just any one person also, but I agree with Louis. You know, there's a lot of people hurting out there with their addiction, you know, even here in my community next door, and then there's people in the tents, and I worry about them right now, you know, with all this rain and everything. And just we got to keep, you know, keeping on in a positive way, in our cultural way, in our indigenous way of prayer, and look out for others that are in need. Be of service. Keep taking care of others, whatever way we can. Aho.
Thank you. Yeah. I want to acknowledge first my brother Yao, that he's not here, but he is here. And in addition to, I just want to recognize my dad, who's dealing with some health issues. He's also a Vietnam vet. These are terrible stories. It reminds me of my dad's experiences. But also to all those babies and those young folks that work within incarceration, that those prayers for them, that they could find balance. And I'm going to close out with this, some words from Roberto. Thank you all for listening to another Lost Souls Radio. And this is Roberto. It's in agreement with Lost Souls Radio. And he says, if you want to know who you are and where you come from, follow the maíz.
To all my people.